The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Turley Frequency with Kevin Turley, a show for you and by you. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881, and share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now, your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Yes, good morning to you. How are you today? It's Thursday, in case you've just woken up. Any school teachers that are having a bit of a lie-in this morning and you've woken up, it's Thursday, and a very nice Thursday it is too. It's a bit gloomy here in London. It's a bit chilly. It's a little bit grey, a bit overcast, the kind of weather we expect really around Christmas time. But I hope it's much nicer wherever you are. I hope the sun is shining, or the rain, if you need the rain for your ground, that is happening. Got a great show for you lined up today. We've got Robert Brennan joining us in the next segment. Robert is one of those people who I've been following for years online. And one of the joys of doing this radio show is that you get to meet these sorts of people. So Robert is a critic and a writer, mainly on film, not exclusively, but mainly on film. And that's why he's coming to talk to us today. He's going to talk to us about film, and I want to pick his brains about Christmas films. I have my own views on that, but it's always good to have another person to sort of joist with on that. So Christmas films are films which may not appear Christmassy, but would be just as good as any others. And just to let you know, at the story time today, I'm going to take you through some wonderful films which I heartily recommend for the Christmas period. And they're a bit unusual. I suspect at least two of them you will never have heard of. So you've got to stick around for that story time coming up later today. Now, as you know, we are running a poll at the moment, and it runs till the end of today, essentially. And that poll is whether tomorrow at story time you want to hear about The Night I Met Count Dracula or The Night I Spent in a Haunted House, because we've decided that Christmas time we'd do something a little bit different, a ghost story to round off the year, round off the show, last show of the year, possibly the last show ever. You never know. So I was going to give you a little bit of autobiography of two very interesting incidents in my life, but it's up to you to decide which one you want. And at the moment, it's easily seen that the Dracula voters have the ascendancy. At the moment, its voting is about 8-4 towards Dracula. But that could change today. There may be somebody listening now who says, no, no, I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear about this haunted house. And you are very easy and very, it's very easy to vote, and you're very welcome to vote. All you got to do is text 251-928-2111 anytime in the next 24 hours, and your vote will be counted. And we'd only be too glad to hear from you. Now, remember, at any time in the show, you can join in the fun. You can phone in and ask questions of our guest, or you can join us for the Divine Mercy at the top of the hour. That's the time when we get together and we pray. And we come together as a praying community to pray for whatever's on our mind, whatever our intentions or needs are. And I just can't believe that you're listening to me this morning and there aren't needs. You don't have needs or intentions, even if it's just that the family gets through Christmas without any hitches, without any problems. I found out this morning that a friend of mine came back from a number of weeks away in the Caribbean to his home in England. And he has a large house in the countryside, and the whole loft had flooded. The pipes had burst, and the flood had gone all the way down into the basement. I mean, after 3 weeks away on holiday, that's the last thing you want to come home to just a few days before Christmas, right? So, you know, we need to pray for protection as well. It's not just the things that we need to sort out today, but it's also asking for God's protection in these coming days. So the Divine Mercy chaplet is coming up at the top of the hour, and you are invited to join us in that. You can text in your requests on the same number as your vote on 251-928-2111, or you can join us on air. You can phone in during that 30 minutes, and we'd be delighted to speak to you if you want to just tell me what your concerns are or help you articulate what it is you want to pray about. And that's 888-928-0881. Now listen, we've only got today and tomorrow, and that's it. So why not? What have you got to lose? What have you got to lose getting us to pray for you? You never know. Something good might happen out of that. Imagine if those numbers, that telephone number and that text number, could enter you into a great prize draw. Just think about this. And that prize draw was for £1 billion, $1 billion. Do you think you would delay phoning 888-928-0881 or texting 251-928-2111? Of course you wouldn't. You'd be straight on the phones. Poor Reed, the soundboard would melt. The phone board would melt as we're receiving all the calls from across southern Alabama. If you knew that there was a fortune at the end of that telephone number. Well, there is a fortune, but it's not a fortune in dollars. It's not a fortune in gold or treasure or anything like that. It's a different type of treasure. It's the treasure of having prayers answered, which may be, for example, a reconciliation between people. It may be that a son or daughter comes back to the church this Christmas. It may be that the operation on your relative goes well and there are no side effects or problems arising from it. It may be an illness that somebody's carrying that you need to have cured. Yeah, we pray for that too. We pray big during that half an hour. It may be the job you're looking for. It may be dealing with a boss you've got or the work colleague that's not really getting on with you. Anything like that. It can be your child at school worrying about what they're being taught, or maybe they're not applying themselves enough to their studies. It can be anything like that. Think about it. We've got 2 days left. This is your chance to get us to pray for your intentions, whatever they are. And as long as you're listening, we're praying for you. Remember that. Now, I was looking around today for stories just for this segment of the show, because there's always sort of weird stories around Christmas time. And a couple of things caught my eyes. I mean, there's a lot of, I have to say that most of the stories about Christmas seem to be about gifts. And maybe that's not surprising, but they're very secular, right, the stories. So, for example, there was the story of the mother who was very upset because she woke up in the middle of the night and she heard a lot of noise. Now, if you remember yesterday during the Divine Mercy Chaplet, there was a lot of noise at my end. And it was because the postman decided we've had strikes. So about a week's worth of post all came at the one time. And it sounded like somebody was breaking the door down. So much post was coming through the door, right? But this mother woke up the other night and rather alarmed. You know, her young family are sleeping and she heard a lot of noise downstairs. And she was understandably concerned. She thought she'd been broken into or whatever. She crept downstairs to have a look. And what did she find? She had three small children, all aged under 5 or 6, I think. And they'd gone downstairs and opened all the presents at 3 a.m. or something. And you can imagine the look of horror on her face that they had all opened all these presents. And when she said to one of them, "What are you doing?" His reply was priceless. He said, "Santa's already been." Santa's already been. So there's lots of stories like that, sort of slightly silly the stories about the secular side. There's a woman complaining that she had applied or ordered these very expensive gifts for her husband, something to do with his car. And instead they sent some really old rusty parts or something. And she was up in arms about this, you know, this sort of, how can you do this a day or two before Christmas? My Christmas is ruined. Well, it's not ruined. It's not ruined. But it's kind of funny how these things start to pop up in the news at this time of year. One of the headlines that caught my attention, which was classic clipbait, was this. 2,000-year-old burial cave is thought to have been that of the midwife to our Lord. Right. Now, I don't know about you, but I immediately clicked on that. I thought, well, this sounds interesting, right? The midwife at Bethlehem, really? But on closer examination, the story is a little bit more mundane. There's an ongoing archaeological dig in Israel with the authorities there. And they've known about this cave for a long time. It's not new. But they've just finally, I mean, in fact, they've known about it for 40 years, okay? So it's not news. But they've decided to investigate it. They've decided to do a proper archaeological dig around it. Thus the headline, I guess. And tradition says that this was the burial site of Salome, who, if you may remember, Salome, from memory, is one of the women mentioned at Calvary. So Salome, according to Christian tradition, lived in Bethlehem and may indeed have been there to help at the help deliver our Lord. So there is a sort of a semblance of tradition that is the base of this story, but it's a kind of strange mix of archaeology, which is very scientific, and tradition, which is based largely on I won't say myth, but it's largely based on sort of ideas that have come down, which may be historic, may not be. They may just be sort of associated with that. But it's interesting that this story drops today, you know, so everybody's clicking on it because it seems like it's breaking news that we have found the cave of the midwife of our Lord, which leads me to wonder. If because the cave is often identified with the nativity scene, right? Because the word in Greek, that in English translation, we talk about no room at the inn, right? But in Greek, it's a little bit more complex. It's sort of that there was no room, there was no extra room, there was no spare room, if you like. And some people have suggested that what had happened was that perhaps, remember, Joseph was of the lineage, as was Our Lady, from the house of Judah. So they may have known some people in Bethlehem, which was where the tribe of Judah were centered. They may have known some people there. But what might have happened was they turned up at some relatives who were inundated with other people for the census and said, look, we haven't got any room, but you can go out back to the cave. The cave and the stable are essentially the same thing. So maybe that's why this kind of confusion around stables and caves and that sort of thing. So I thought that was sort of interesting that this has popped up at this time. And then the other thing which pops up at this time, inevitably, are stories about stars in the sky, right? And there was... Well, before that, there was something which dropped yesterday, which was that the Pentagon, I don't know why they're doing this. Maybe you do. Maybe you know, and let me know if you do. Phone in and tell me on 888-928-0881. But there seems to be an awful lot of stories about UFOs emanating from the Pentagon. Now, when I was growing up, UFO stories were, there were lots of them, but they never came from governments, right? They came from every other source but the government. But the Pentagon seems to be playing a strange game where it's talking about, for example, several hundred UFO reports, that's their words, received by their new tracking office, right? So hundreds and hundreds of UFO reports at something called the Anomaly Resolution Office. Yeah, I know it sounds absolutely like something out of a sci-fi movie, right? Actually, it's the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, right? And it's only been set up in July of this year, I think. So I'm wondering why they're doing this, because the only message that's coming out from them is that there is no evidence of alien life. So whatever they're seeing, or whatever people are seeing in the skies, it's not leading to any conclusion at the top level that there is alien life. Which is interesting. Now, if you've ever seen a UFO or maybe you've been abducted by one, I'd love to hear from you. Welcome to come on the show anytime. We will stop any guest in their tracks if you have had that experience. But it's interesting they're talking about lights in the sky, because we always think about the light in the sky at this time of the year. We think about Bethlehem. And there was the usual stuff that was coming out again on things like Twitter, which said that the star Bethlehem would appear again this year on December 21st, so yesterday. And that it would be the first time that this star had appeared since the Middle Ages. I don't know how they work these things out, and I don't know what star they're referring to. But as always, the truth is a little bit more prosaic, because it seems that this indication that the Star of Bethlehem will shine again for the first time in centuries has been something which is constantly regurgitated every single time around the solstice. And a quick check showed that it was completely false, that there were no stars in the sky expected. So no UFOs with alien life and no stars in the sky. But I think that all of these stories, whether it's open presence or no stars and no alien, they're missing the point. They're missing the point. Now, I came across a wonderful story the other day, and I'm going to try to sum it up for you very quickly in the few minutes I've got left. And most of you will know where this story comes from, but if not, I will let you know in due course. It starts really with, I'm going to update it a little bit from where it was written and when it was written. So basically, it's a story of a man who is a decent man, good man, right? Good to his family, upright in his dealings, good worker, no problems. But he just doesn't believe in Christianity, doesn't believe in the church, doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe that God became man, lived among us. So he says to his wife on Christmas Eve, look, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to Mass with you tonight. Right? He says he'd feel a hypocrite if he did go, and he'd much rather just stay home, and he'll wait up for her and the kids to come back. Reluctantly, she said, okay, and off she went. Now, after the wife and children drove off, snow began to fall. And he went to the window to watch the flurries getting heavier and heavier, and then went back to his fireside chair and watched television or looked on the internet, whatever he was doing, just to pass the time. And moments later, he was startled by a thudding sound. And then another and another, sort of a thud or a thump. At first, he thought someone must be throwing snowballs against his living room window. But when he went to the front door to investigate, he found a flock of birds huddled miserably in the snow. And they had been caught in the storm, and in a desperate search for shelter, had tried to fly through his large landscape window. Well, he couldn't let the poor creatures lie there and freeze, so he remembered the barn attached to the back of the house, maybe the garage, where his children had stabled their pony. And he thought that would provide a nice warm shelter if he could direct the birds to go there. So quickly he put on his coat and his outdoor shoes and all the rest, and he tramped out through the deepening snow to the barn, and he opened the doors wide, turned on the light, but the birds didn't come in. And he figured, therefore, well, he has to do something to entice them. So he put out little breadcrumbs to see if that would entice the birds to come in. He sprinkled it on the snow, making a trail to the yellow-lighted, wide-open doorway of the stable. But to his dismay, the birds ignored the breadcrumbs and continued to flap around helplessly in the snow. He tried catching them. He tried shooing them into the barn by walking around, waving his arms. Instead, they scattered in every direction, except into the lighted, warm barn. And then he realized that they were afraid of him. And he reckoned that he must come across as a rather strange, large, frightening figure. So he thought to himself, if only I could think of some way to let them know that they can trust me, that I'm not trying to hurt them, but to help them. But how? Because any move he made tended to frighten them, to confuse them. They would just not follow him. And then he thought to himself, if only I could be a bird and mingle with them and speak their language, then I could tell them not to be afraid. Then I could show them the way to a safe and warm barn. But I would have to be one of them so that they could see me, hear me, and understand me. And at that moment, he heard the church bells ringing. And the sound reached his ears above the sounds of the wind, the sound of a choir singing, Adeste Fideles, O come all you faithful, and stood there in the snow. The man listened to the bells pealing and the glad tidings of Christmas. And as he did so, he sank to his knees in the snow. Most of you will know who wrote that story. It was Paul Harvey. It's a beautiful story and something that really captures, in my imagination, what it is about Christmas. Okay, when we come back, we are going to be talking Christmas movies and movies of all stripes with Paul Brennan coming to us live from Los Angeles this morning. I hope he's up and I hope he's ready. So I'll be back with you after these words. Stay with me here on Archangel Radio.
Welcome back to the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881 and share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Yes, welcome back. It's great to have you here this morning with me on the Turley Frequency. I'm your host, Kevin Turley, for the next couple of hours, and I'm delighted to say that we are going to be talking movies. I don't know about you, but Christmas time is a time when we have a little bit more time on our hands, right? We're not so pressured, and it's a good time to bring the family together to watch a film, talk about it. It's something which can become memorable to the whole Christmas holidays. But the problem these days is what to watch. There is so much choice, first of all, that's the first problem. There seems to be an endless array of films to watch, but also what could be suitable for certain families or certain ages, and all of that debate which has been raging since Hollywood lost its mind around about the end of the 1960s. Now, to help us with this, I'm delighted to say that we are being joined by Robert Brennan, all the way from Los Angeles. Now, Robert is a professional writer and has been for many decades, with extensive credits in the television industry as well as Catholic journalism. He's written for such wonderful periodicals as This Rock or Sunday Visitor, and also the National Catholic Register. He pens his Ad Rem column in Angelus, the official news source of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, and only this year was awarded the best regular column in the general commentary category for the Catholic Media Awards for 2022. So, Robert, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Well, thank you so much. That was a nice intro. I was wondering who you were talking about.
I hope it's you, Robert. Yeah. Otherwise, I've got it totally wrong.
Okay.
Now, first of all, Robert, can I say thank you for getting up so early?
Oh, no worries. Not at all. No problem.
What time is it in LA at the moment?
It is 6:25. Wow. But I'm an early riser. I do my... I've always, when I write, I always write in the early morning. It's quiet, it's my time, and it helps keep my brain focused.
A wise man. I know that time of the morning, and it's the best time to write, as far as I'm concerned. I couldn't agree more. Now, Robert, I have to say that one of the joys of doing a radio show like this is that I get the excuse to talk to people that I've always wanted to talk to. Now, I've been following your writing for quite some time and intrigued by what you wrote about cinema. And I've often thought Robert's the sort of guy I'd love to go for a pint with down the pub and have a chat with about all things cinematic. But we can't meet together. You're in LA and I'm in London, but we can meet in the middle in Mobile via the wonders of the internet and have a chat about cinema. So I hope you've got a good, strong cup of coffee. And what I'd like to talk to you about, really, is Christmas movies. But I'd like to ask you, really, first of all, what's it like living in L.A., writing about the movie industry?
Well, you know, it's interesting since, as you mentioned, I spent over 25 years working in the industry. I always felt like I was a typical guy who grew up in a small town and dropped out of college and went to work in the local factory. It just happened to be the movie and television industry. And when, you know, growing up at the time I did, you know, we only saw movies either in a movie theater or on the late show. And I fell in love with movies on TV, watching them and discovering the movies, you know, that were made before I was born and onward. And it's interesting in this town because I still, you know, have friends and know people who are in the business, but it's nice to have sort of a 30,000 foot level look at it sometimes, to be out of it to look in to give us a better perspective.
Yeah, it's true. But I guess because London is very cinematic as well. You know, there's been a lot of films made here, based here. The studios are ringed around London, the classic film studios. But I mean, I guess LA, you can't move in the city without seeing something that might have been used as a backlot or a shooting location of some sort.
Well, you know what's interesting, Kevin, is where I live in the San Fernando Valley, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. I could spend an hour trying to explain the craziness of how the city of Los Angeles is mapped out. I'm 20 miles from downtown Los Angeles, but I'm the city of Los Angeles. Well, about a mile from me used to be the Columbia Ranch, which is where they shot the exteriors of It's a Wonderful Life. And you're right, everywhere you go, where I live in the San Fernando Valley, oh yeah, that's the place where John Wayne used to live, or this is the place where they shot a specific, you know, movie or TV program. It permeates the culture here in Southern California.
Yeah, and that makes it all the sort of more sort of fascinating, I think, when it comes to that, because I don't know about you, given probably both our fertile imaginations, sometimes reality and fiction kind of merge. You know, you almost see the cinematic city rather than. But I mean, the thing about L.A., Robert, to Europeans, I've been to L.A. once, and New York, I can kind of get my head around it, as we say here, you know, L.A. couldn't begin to understand where it began,
no.
Where it ended.
Yeah.
Thank heavens there's a Pacific Ocean. Otherwise, I'd have got completely lost. You know what I mean? It was that sort of
mm-hmm.
city. But listen, let's go back to some, because your childhood sounds very much like mine. I grew up watching very old films on television and knowing nothing about them. And those films still resonate with me today. So, for example, just to give you an LA example, I remember being allowed to sit up late one night, and I must have been about 12, to watch Double Indemnity. Now, I knew nothing about it. I don't know why I was watching it, but I remember watching that film thinking, this is amazing. And nobody seems to understand why, you know. Now, I was the only 12-year-old at school who had even heard of Double Indemnity, and nobody watched black and white movies. So I was out on a limb. Is that the kind of childhood you had?
That's it to a T. I loved that movie, by the way. In fact, Turner Classic Movies does a program where they'll show the movies that some of the selected movies that they have, they put in movie theaters. And my family and I, we've seen Casablanca on a big screen, and we saw, my daughter and I went to see Double Indemnity. And it is truly amazing the difference. When you see the movie the way it was intended to be seen on a large screen, it's a completely new experience. It's amazing. And the fact that is still available to us, I highly recommend it, because you hear things and you see things, and the way the scenes are constructed it's almost like seeing a new movie. It's amazing.
Yeah. You're listening to Robert Brennan live with me this morning here on Archangel Radio, and he's coming to us live from the heart of the world of cinema, which is LA. How many miles are you from Hollywood, Robert?
Maybe 15 miles. You know, everything's far. You know, you get in your car and you go. You know, the other thing about Los Angeles, which is, you know, you realize when you said you couldn't figure it out, well, it doesn't make any sense. So how could you? It's a major city that's not really on a body of water or a major river. We have to steal our water from 250 miles away. You know, so it shouldn't really exist in the size that it is. So it has all these disparate influences and cultures, and it is a mishmash, that's for sure. And I think the movies and the way the movie industry developed sort of reflects that.
I don't know if you've ever seen it was a British documentary series called Hollywood. Did you ever see that from 1980?
Yes, with James Mason narrated it. I love that documentary.
Sorry, Robert.
I have a very tenuous connection with the silent movie industry. A relative in our family, we always called him Uncle Joe, but he was actually married to my dad's cousin. Mm-hmm. He was a silent movie director, and he worked with D.W. Griffith. And I knew him. He was an old man when I was a kid, but he would come over to at family parties and tell stories, and it was just amazing. You know, he was actually in Birth of a Nation. He played Abraham Lincoln. His name was Joe Henneberry. And so from an early age, I was sort of filled with that kind of sense of, wow, this is this magic world that, you know, I've been plopped into.
That's incredible. What was Joe's surname?
Henneberry, Joseph Henneberry.
And did he go on to direct feature films?
He did. He directed a Rudolph Valentino movie and several other movies.
Which Valentino movie, Robert?
The title escapes me, but I actually have a reproduction of the poster somewhere here.
That's incredible.
But you know, he was a very interesting, amazing guy. And you know, at a time when, like, out here in the San Fernando Valley in the 20s and the 30s, it really was wide open. Now it's all built up. It's suburban, and there's towns and cities in the valley. But in the day, the movies could come out here and they could make it any land they wanted it to be. It could be a desert. It could be a forest. It could be whatever they needed it to be.
I absolutely loved that series, and it completely colored my imagination about Hollywood and Southern California and that very romantic era when something is beginning and starting. Yesterday on the show, Robert, I was telling people about the anniversary of Charles Chaplin's first screen test, which was roughly now. I mean, they don't know the exact date, but they reckon it was yesterday. And, you know, you probably know the story about how he was discovered.
I'm not sure I do.
Well, I mean, I said it all yesterday, so, but I'll give you the the thumbnail sketch.
I should have been listening.
No. It's for the audience who would be bored by it again. But it's a great story because he was a vaudevillian performer in an English troupe, and they came to America on a tour. And he did the tour, and he was about to leave the States. And in Hollywood at the Keystone Company, they had been making short comedy films, and the chief comic had fallen out with the director, well-worn tale, right? Stormed off the set, never going to work again. So they were sitting around saying, well, we need a comic. And one of the guys said, I saw this limey comic on stage in such and such a town. They said, well, who is he? And said, well, we don't know who he is. And said, well, find him. We could try him for a screen test, whatever, you know. So they put out this sort of manhunt to find Charlie Chaplin. And I think they got him just before he got on the boat to England and enticed him to come to Hollywood to do a screen test. And he was told to dress up for the screen test. So he went to the wardrobe and he didn't like what they were suggesting. And instead he put on the derby hat, the tight jacket, the baggy shirt, baggy trousers, and the big boots, and the cane, and the moustache. And he walked out in front of the camera. The director shouted, action. The rest, as they say, is history. But it was that kind of place, right, Hollywood? I mean, you could go there. I mean, I was talking about Frank Capra the other day. It was exactly the same. Frank Capra is probably a bit like yourself. He grew up in Hollywood or grew up in Los Angeles, drifted. He was a chemical engineer, for goodness sake, drifted into Hollywood, started writing gags. Next minute, he's directing Oscar-winning films.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever read his autobiography, the name above the title. It's a great book and very, very insightful. And, of course, you know, he's tagged into, you know, one of the all-time Christmas movies.
He is. And we're going to do Christmas movies if you've got time to hang around for the next segment. Is that okay, Robert?
Absolutely. I've got more coffee.
Because I'm really enjoying talking to you. I want to ask you straight up. Now, this is a question which you're not going to thank me for, and you may refuse to answer and hang up immediately. But give me some of your favorite films of all time. And don't think too much about it, because if you're like me, if you start thinking about it, nothing comes out. Just give me some of those films that you think, yes, yes, yes.
Well, it's kind of easy, because I have an all-time favorite. It's The Third Man.
Really?
Yes. You
tell me why.
Know of it? Because on multiple levels. One, I love the writing, the look of the film. You know, Carol Reed was a very underappreciated director, even though he got accolades in his time. But he's not remembered like he should be. The fact that the city becomes a character, I mean, it's some guys have been able to do that as well, but no one did it like he did in that movie. And their humor, the dark humor in it, and just for the the merry-go-round scene, what Orson Welles does, it just blows me away. And the ending, too, which was not a Hollywood ending, which Selznick, because it was produced by Fox, he was absolutely dead-set against it, did not want that ending. And Carol Reed dug his heels in and said, nope, it's got to end that way. And it makes it a great film. I think it's just amazing.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, the thing that I remember most about that film, and I saw that on the big screen, actually, is the Orson Welles entry. Do you know that moment?
Yes. Oh, and when they meet for that, it's really, Orson Welles has one scene.
That's right.
And it's such a powerful scene. And it's so true today, because if you look at the pro-life movement, well, that's what they've done to babies. They turned them into dots.
Yeah.
When he's looking down and says, look, if someone said I'd give you so much money for how many dots, you'd be thinking how many dots, you could eliminate. So I find it timeless. It really is. It isn't trapped in its time, even though the post-war era is absolutely essential to what the film is and why the characters are the way they are. It just resonates today to me.
And you're probably familiar with the source material, the Graham Greene novel.
Yeah, and Graham Greene's one of my favorite novelists too. So it's a perfect storm for me, that movie.
It is, but it's a very good example where cinema occasionally exceeds the material. I've got a theory, Robert, that great books are unfilmable, but mediocre or okay books can make great films.
Well, it's interesting because Graham Greene always separated his books into two categories. They were like entertainments, and then they were novels. And
that's right.
The Third Man is a film noir detective story. And you're right, it does translate.
And you do know that Graham Greene was a film critic himself in the 1930s for the Spectator magazine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, another great film critic who was a great writer, but a very brief one, it was James Agee.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar,
yes,
The Asking Queen. And he wrote one of my other favorite movies, which is Night of the Hunter.
Ah, Night of the Hunter. Robert Mitchum's greatest moment, would you say?
And Charles Laughton, who the only movie he directed, and he was such a, sensitive soul, to say the least, that because the critics didn't like it, he was crushed, and so he never directed again. And that's a shame, because it's a brilliant film.
Robert, don't move a muscle. You can have a drink of your coffee, but don't go anywhere, because we're talking movies. We're going to be talking Christmas movies in the next segment with Robert Brennan, live from Los Angeles. And we will be back straight after these words. Don't go away.
Welcome back to the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. And share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now, your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Yes, you're back with me here on the Turley Frequency. My name is Kevin Turley. I'm coming to you live from London and also live from Los Angeles. We have Robert Brennan, who is a writer, a film critic, a survivor of the film industry, and much more besides. Robert, welcome back to the Turley Frequency.
Great to be back.
Now, you mentioned Carol Reed, and you also mentioned James Mason. So you know what I'm going to ask you about, don't you?
I have a hunch.
Odd Man Out. What do you think of that?
Well, I actually wrote a piece about that. It's the way of the cross. And the only problem I have with it is when it kind of stops. It kind of stops in the middle of it, and he has that moment with the actor's the name just escapes me. Robert Newton.
The painter.
You know, and I like Robert Newton, but he does have a tendency to chew scenery, and that's the only thing that bothers me about that film. But the rest of it is brilliant. I love that film.
Well,
it's a very
allegorical. LA. I grew up in and around Belfast, and it's the strangest film about. It's the best film I've ever seen about that part of the world. And yet, you probably know that none of it was filmed there. Some of the exterior shots were taken there, but none of it was filmed. It was all done on a stage set about 6 miles from where I'm speaking to you this morning. So it's weird.
Which
the,
I think
the wonders-
adds to it. It adds to that surrealness of it and of his journey. So that. You know, and those are times in the Night of the Hunter, the same thing. He uses very strange sets, and they're almost from like German impressionism of the, you know, the silent German films. And, you know, I think that augments the film.
Well, you see, I think that that's what cinema does best. Not documentary reality, you know, but but a sort of hyper reality, a hyper fantasy almost of what's real, so that it becomes kind of mythic in your mind. And Odd Man Out, as I say, is the best film ever made about Belfast, and it's nowhere near it. There's lots of films made about LA that probably never escape from the backlot at Warner Brothers, but capture something of the essence of wherever it is they're trying to capture. And that's the magic of cinema. Now, talking of the magic of cinema, let's move to Christmas. Now, I have to say, Robert, you know, that sometimes people say it'd be great to have a feature about Christmas movies, and you know what, my heart starts to sink at that point, because leaving aside Mr. Capra, and we'll come to him in a minute, try to help me, because Christmas movies to me are either really slocky Hallmarky type movies, or they are sort of secular where they use the trappings of Christmas but they have no meaning of Christmas whatsoever to them. I'm struggling to find real films that capture what the true spirit of Christmas is, so help me out.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I totally agree. And, you know, with the Hallmark Channel, I didn't know there were so many, you know, handsome, hunky sheriffs who are widowers with precocious children who, you know, encounter these hard-driving women executives from New York whose car breaks down in Connecticut. But
I thought they were all like that, Robert.
Yeah.
You mean they aren't?
But I feel your pain when I hear the spirit of Christmas in, you know, is brought up in movies. I start to shiver myself. And you know, the number one culprit is Charles Dickens. He invented the spirit of Christmas trope. And you know, and he had a problematic relationship with Christianity, but that being said, for popular entertainment, you know, all the different versions of A Christmas Carol, actually one of them, the 1951 version with Alistair Sim, I love that film. And it does sort of, you know, without, you know, obviously it is not overtly Christian in any way, but in other facets it is. And it's about redemption and forgiveness and charity. And it's just, I don't mind, you know, I'm not that dark with my Irish ancestry that I can't accept some brightness in life. And, you know, I have to admit, maybe it's a guilty pleasure, but I do like that version of A Christmas Carol. And I can forgive it for its spirit of Christmas.
Well, Robert, you and I are on the same page, because that is my favorite Christmas film as well. Absolutely. For a number of reasons. First of all, it was a Belfast director that directed it, Brian Desmond Hirst. So he directed it. And one of my favorite actors is in it, who is Alistair Sim, who I think is one of the most underrated screen performers, certainly in Britain, ever.
Oh, absolutely. He's terrific. You know, he could do, and most people who do know of him think of him only as, you know, in comic performances, but he could be a dramatic actor as well.
Absolutely. Have you ever seen him in, Green Is for Danger? You ever seen that film?
No. I'll have to
freely available online. I'm not going to give them any benefit, but you know where you can find it for free.
Okay.
Just to let people know, because we're going to get carried away, you and I can see,
I know.
Robert, that was a film called, in America it was called A Christmas Carol, in the UK it was called Scrooge, and it's a 1951 classic starring Alistair Sim, who was a wonderful British actor, and it's freely available, I think. I mean, again, if you do a Google search, you will find Scrooge 1951 with Alistair Sim, and it's a wonderful, wonderful film. What's your view on the colorization of films, Robert?
I hate it.
Hey, listen, you're answering all these questions right. You're going to get the top prize. You know that.
Oh, and good, good.
And the top prize is you have to come back.
Oh, rats. I thought it was going to be a Cadillac.
No, but absolutely with you on that. Because there's something very beautiful in monochrome, right?
You know, Kevin, I spent a good portion of my life the last 20 years getting my daughter to accept black and white film. And she finally has. She still has a blind spot with Casablanca, which she doesn't like, but she's a work in progress. But she now finally understands that, no, it doesn't all have to be in Technicolor and bright everything. Sometimes the shadows and the black and white makes it, and for, you know, most of the time, the reason they chose it was not for some great artistic decisions, that's, they didn't have enough money for color. It was expensive to shoot, but the end result is beautiful.
I must tell you a brief story on that, Robert, if I may, because I have had the same battle, right, trying to get younger people in particular to watch black and white films. But about 25 years ago, a film which I had wanted to see for all my life, don't ask me how I came across it, I can't even remember, it was called The Passion of Joan of Arc, the Carl Dreyer film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it finally was on in a cinema in London, and I was so excited. And it was at that time my life had lots of friends, and I said to them, I'm going to the cinema. And they said, what are you going to see? I said, The Passion of Joan of Arc. They said, we'll come with you. I said, great. So the six of us trotted off. We were all young men, right? And we got to the cinema, and it was one of those art house cinemas. And one of them picked up the bump, and they were looking at it saying, Kevin, is this film in black and white? I said, yeah. And they went, oh, no, you know, why didn't you tell us? And then we were in the queue and we bought our tickets. And then one of them said, wait a minute, is this film silent? Right? And I said, yes. And they went, you got to be kidding me. They said, there'll be nobody at it, Kevin, you know, da, 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 da. Anyway, it turned out we got the last six tickets, right? Sold out. We went in, we watched it. And it's a film, I'm sure you know, one of my favorite films of all time. And we came out, you know, after that harrowing final shot, right? We came out and I looked at them and said, well, and they said, wow, what a film. So,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes you just got to, if you're listening and you haven't tried black and white or you even haven't tried silent films, Robert and me are your worst nightmare. Okay.
Yeah. Start with like a Chaplin or Buster Keaton short, you know.
Absolutely.
That's a good gateway drug to start the process. And then you can move into, you know, some of the deeper stuff. And it's just amazing.
Give us some recommendations on that front. If you're listening and you got kids, silent movies are great because they can make as much noise as they want while they're watching them. So give us a Chaplin or a Buster Keaton or anybody else of the silent era, comedic, short, funny. What would you recommend, Robert?
One of my all-time favorites is I love Keaton. I love Keaton and Laurel and Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
They can do no wrong. There's one called Cops where Buster Keaton he's a junk man. And it's a one reel comedy. It takes, you know, 8-9 minutes and you're done. And he just winds up through a series of, you know, ridiculous happenstance. He's being chased by about 300 cops. And it's just lovely. And especially for young people because it's so visual and it's so over the top. And he was such a remarkable physical comedian. I think, that would be, and then The Music Box by Stan and Ollie, where they're trying to pull a piano box up those steps, which I have seen those steps, you know, those steps still exist here in LA.
That's what I was going to ask you, Robert. I was going to say, do they actually still exist? But they do. That's wonderful.
They do.
That's absolutely wonderful. I've just done a quick search, and Buster Keaton's Cops from 1922 is freely available, 18 minutes, 32 seconds long. And I'm going to watch that tonight because I'm a big Buster Keaton fan, but I haven't seen that one, unfortunately.
Oh, watch it. I would love to know what you thought, because it kills me. I've seen it 100 times. It still makes me laugh.
Well, look, Robert, you're coming back. You're not getting out of this. You've won the prize, so you got to come back.
Oh, that's, okay.
So we will be reviewing Buster Keaton's The Cops. I'm trying to think if I can recommend. So, I mean, you've seen all the classic Chaplin stuff, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And my son, my oldest son, who, he's my crowning glory. I completely corrupted him in films, and he's got his own library of DVDs, silent films. He loves the movie Metropolis.
Yes.
And Keaton and Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, and then movies from the 20s up through, present day. So
you probably have seen the Charlie Chaplin quote after he saw Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer. And he said, "What a shame," he said, "just when we were getting it right."
That's great, and it's so true. That movie, for the accomplishment of sound, yay. Everything else about that movie, no thanks.
But
and a 45-year-old man, having trouble with his dad is also kind of weird.
Absolutely, but and let's not go into all of that. But
okay.
Going back to the Hollywood series that we're talking about, which we heartily recommend, and which is also available if you do a quick Google search. Can't tell you where, but you know where it is. All 8 or 9 parts. I can't remember how many parts there are. But you know that final episode where it looks at the coming of sound. You know that bit, Robert?
Mm-hmm.
By the time you finish this series, you get it, that sound wasn't this kind of nirvana. It wasn't this sort of promised land. It was the end of something which was purely cinematic.
Yes, it was the end of the universal aspect of film.
Totally. Totally.
Because then, language and, it changed everything. It really did, and not all for the better, because you didn't have to know how to speak German to understand what was going on in Metropolis, and you didn't have to know English to understand what was going on in the Gold Rush.
Well, that's true, and I said that yesterday. That Charlie Chaplin was as famous in then Peking as he was in Piccadilly, or he was in Los Angeles as he was in Hanoi. I mean, it didn't matter. It was a universal language. Now we've strayed from Christmas movies to silent movies. I'm going to throw a film at you and wonder if you've seen it. And it's called A Cottage on Dartmoor.
I'm not familiar.
Right. Now, and this is going to bore everybody that's not into silent movies, but anyway, it's a great film. But it's I tell you what it is, Robert, it's a film that you will enjoy for this reason. You know that European cinema, other than Germany, was hit and miss in the 1920s, okay? The French were doing rather large epics. The Scandinavians were doing some things. The British were really lagging behind, with one exception, Mr. Alfred Hitchcock, who had gone to Germany and learned some of the techniques of German filmmakers and come back and made such films as The Lodger and that sort of thing, okay? But just as sound was starting, the British cinema finally made a classic. An absolute classic. Now, they had to have virtually, the whole thing is staffed by Europeans of various hue, but it's a brilliant film called A Cottage on Dartmoor. I thoroughly recommend it. Listen, Robert, it's gone far too quick. You're going to have to come back.
I'd be happy to. This was great. I love talking movies.
Okay, listen, thanks very much, Robert, and have a wonderful Christmas when it comes, and we'll talk again in the new year.
Thanks, Kevin. Merry Christmas to you.
And when we come back, we're talking not silent movies, we're talking Divine Mercy, and you've got to stick around for that. Stay with me.